Du lytter til Enneagrammet Next Level Podcast. Din vært er Flemming Christensen.
Today, I'm sitting here with the Nyen that I met at a conference, I think, in Cairo, or is it 5 years ago or something? And just been to a conference with in Cairo or a couple of weeks ago. And you kind of agreed to make this interview. So I'm very, very happy that we can have this talk together, and very welcome, Nyen, to the studio.
Yeah, very glad to be here. Thank you for asking. Yeah.
I feel that I know you very well. And maybe it's due to the interview that you made of me, or maybe a year ago, and I felt so safe. And it was like you guided me into the interview with such an elegance that I said, wow, time just went by, and you were a beautiful guide. So I have the ambition to see if I can be as beautiful a guide as you were back then. And I know people have noticed that about you, that you have a certain way of guiding people. I was looking at some of the reviews on your website, and one of them said, she's not teaching, she's guiding us.
Wow.
So, do you recognize that?
Yeah, that sounds beautiful. That's what I would hope, right? Mm. Because I think that, you know, even the teaching model, at least historically, is like teaching from on high, right? And guiding feels more like companionship or friendship, which is really how I like to hold it, that we're on this journey together. And sometimes I stumble as well, you know, and yet sometimes if we hold hands, we'll make it.
I love that.
You know, yeah.
How lovely. And I was reading again on your website, Evolving Enneagram, that you encountered the Enneagram around 2002.
Yeah, ages ago, huh?
How did that happen? How did the meeting go?
Oh, wow. Well, okay. If you really want to know, it was actually the same weekend that I left my law job in San Francisco, and I asked my husband for a divorce. And so I basically had gotten a whole big stack of books from like the local bookstore, thinking I'm going to figure this out, right? I'm going to figure out my life and what, you know, seems to be going wrong repeatedly. And one of those books happened to be an Enneagram book. And yeah, so that was a huge game changer for my life. I remember reading it. I did initially, you know, there are a lot of commonalities between the type one and the type three. I mean, both are rational competency types who tend to be efficient and effective. At first, I thought I was a one because, you know, there's this description about ones needing to be right all the time. And I was like, wow, I realized my whole life up until then, I was right. I mean, not really, but I thought I was. And I only surrounded myself with people who thought I was. And if they didn't think I was, they were out, basically. So, yeah. So really, really easy to live with back then. Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah, that's basically my meeting with the Enneagram was humbling. And let's just say that the first thing I did is I called my ex on the phone and I apologized. Mm. Because it wasn't till I read that description, frankly, that I came to see something about myself that I really couldn't see until then. Mm. You know, so the Enneagram was really the beginning for me of some self-awareness that, like, you know, again, it's not like I wasn't philosophical and self-reflective, but the Enneagram really helps us to see things we just can't see without that hard, accurate mirror, if you will. So that was my meeting of the Enneagram.
Yeah.
Humbly.
Thank you for sharing that. And and how did you actually get to understand where you kind of belonging to the Enneagram, finding your type and all that. How was that process?
Well, I didn't realize we'd start with such a humbling question like these questions. Well, all of this has been like one embarrassment after another. It took me years, frankly, to discern that. But basically, over the years, I did a lot of inner work based on thinking I was a type one. And the good fortune is that I also, a couple of years after meeting the Enneagram, I found unity. And unity as a spiritual belief system, if you will, or framework, teaches that we are made in original blessing, not in original sin. This idea that we are actually born whole and perfect as we are. And that teaching is something that I've integrated and lived with over the years. And the invitation to that, I'm now realizing, is such a salve for the three, because there's this way in which it says you are whole and you are enough exactly as you are. And so without realizing it, I was starting on a healing path that is also good for type threes, to the point where only several years ago, I mean, I've been teaching the Enneagram for, you know, since 2007 now, only several years ago did I have this moment where I realized that, oh, this inner critic that's been on my shoulder for like all of my life until now, I couldn't feel it anymore. Like I physically, it was almost like I physically felt like something had been lifted. And I remember having this thought. I thought, you know, Nian, you've evolved, but you're not that evolved. Like you can't just have something so core to your personality type structure be gone. Like just completely be gone. Because people say that, you know, they're like, oh, yes, I'm this number, but I'm so evolved, right? And I'm like, that's very suspicious. And all this time, I was already like, you know, on the fence about type three. It's not like it was a huge surprise. But at that point, I revisited the type three in a more like essential way. And it was actually Almas's description, Hamid Ali is his real name. Almas is his pen name. His description in Keys to the Enneagram just a few years ago that really nailed it for me, because I had never heard anyone describe a three so beautifully, whereas a lot of the three's descriptions are often cliche, stereotype, everyone's, you know, just ambitious and things like that. And I was like, that doesn't match my life experience. But his description talked about this idea of wanting to live as an exemplary human being. And I remember all my life, I thought, if I lived in such a way that if everybody lived like I lived, the world would be a better place. That was like my mantra since I was a kid. And I never equated that with threeness, because the descriptions of threes are horrible. You know, like they're like, you know, competitive, this and that. I was like, oh, I actually want to be the kind of person that, like, if the world were this person, you know, like if everyone was like this, the world would be better. And that's kind of where the confusion with one and three was. But once I saw it, then all these very subtle things that I just naturally do. And I think, you know, that whole idea is like you do it well, so you don't even see that you're doing it. But that, oh yeah, in my Zoom meeting with a group of people, how am I able to just gently adjust to the audience, right? Or how do I, as a sexual three, you know, with my partners, I think about the different boyfriends or partners I've had, I'm like, huh, you know, noticing how I would just subtly dress a little bit differently, you know, in accordance with what I thought he found attractive, you know, and that's just, it was so almost, quote, natural to me. Again, that's the cliche, that the habit is so natural, you think it's you. Yeah. And then the threes issue is identification, which is we identify with our own lie about ourselves, which is so sad, right? So yeah. So that's basically how I came upon it and how embarrassed. I mean, I've been teaching for years, right? So how many videos do I have out there where I'm like, yeah, as a one, ouch. Yeah, but I wouldn't have been able to do it but for the self-love that has grown over the years as a result of my spiritual journey, because that self-love trumps the need for approval, right? Because that's more important, that truth and authenticity have become more important than approval, right? Yeah.
Was it painful? I know it was embarrassing, but was it painful to kind of find another frame to see yourself with or through? Or
I think that at this point, I don't know if painful would be the term. It was actually strangely liberating. And this may sound weird because I think people who meet me now might be like, well, she's so obviously three. And I think what the issue is, there's a different levels of authenticity, right? And owning that I was a three was also at the point where I realized that the reason I wouldn't even let myself know that is because I had so deeply shamed and rejected any ounce of ambition inside of me. You know, that these things that were three-like qualities, whether because of my family culture or background, they were so like rejected, like inside of me, that once I owned the three, it was like a big owning. I'm like, I'm going to be flamboyantly, you know, it's like I'm finally allowed to unleash something that I feel like the desire to be one-ish held together. And so there's a level of authenticity in that. It's like freeing my life force in a certain way. Yeah.
So coming back to something real.
Hopefully, yes. And that there are ways in which, because I was told that wanting to do something big in the world, like in my family, for instance, there was this, I mean, I remember even just wanting to move to go to law school and be away from my family is something that they didn't think was a good idea. You know, so in my family, the idea that you want to stay near family, you want to support the family, you don't want to do anything outside. Like, why would you care? Even becoming a minister was something confusing to them, that in a way was deemed selfish because it was something for the world and not necessarily for our family. So opening up was kind of opening to this freedom of saying that there is a core part of me, and it's not wrong, that wants to have impact and cares to help people beyond my own family. And that's always been in me. And yet it was kind of like damped down and repressed to say, like, okay, but I need to do the dutiful daughter thing and become a lawyer and make good money. I mean, a minister, like, what do you, you know, like, like, what crazy business is that, right? You know, but like, your lawyer, make money and send money home, you know, kind of, yeah. And so it was actually a very, quote, selfish act to leave and go and follow my passion. Yeah, from that perspective.
For me, you're speaking in what I see as one of the essence quality of type three is creating something of value for others together with others. That and that can sound to be very ambitious or having an idea about that I'm large and I can do larger than me, but still there is beauty in that. Hey, let's do something together with others, and what we do is benefiting others. So that's a little bit what you talk about, but I can understand if you have a family that is kind of a little more focused on family, then going out there and do something for the bigger world, that could be a little extravagant.
Yes. And I would add not only that, but also, you know, I identify as self-preservation repressed. And I think my family is strong in that instinct. So family and security.
Yeah.
And what I was doing had neither, basically financial security. And so I saw it as, they just care about money and they want me to make money. Looking back, I understand. I have more compassion and understanding for just their desire because we were immigrants as well. So we had fled Vietnam, come to the U.S. My dad had $15 in his pocket. He raised five kids. You know, and he started as a janitor at the local sewage plant. So looking back, I'm like, well, Nian, of course, like he sacrificed. My family sacrificed so much to put us through school so we could have some stability and security. And here I was going, I don't want that, you know, kind of. And so looking back, I see now how confusing it was for them. But back then it just felt like they don't support me, you know, they don't want me to be happy. And yeah, so thank God for the Enneagram and just learning about the differences among us, right? Yeah.
Thanks for sharing.
Yeah.
And then there is this book coming out in 25, Enneagram of Soul.
Yeah.
Is that kind of the whole extraction or essence of everything you have experienced in that book, or does it have a particular path or towards that book, or what can we expect to find in the book?
There is this saying that I think I said this at my talk in Egypt, that we teach what we most need to learn. And I think we give the world from our own wound. We give what we needed. And I think the book is just one maybe beginning piece of that. It's not the end all be all. It's just like maybe the first gift. Hmm. And so what is this thing that I needed? When I was young, I had a quest for meaning that was very alive for me just in my childhood. And in my family, nobody talked about religion or spirituality. And my parents, my dad was actually Buddhist, but philosophically so. But I had these pressing questions about the meaning of life and all that. And I was seeking, and I kept seeking through different religions and not finding one in which I fit, and not really understanding the difference between spirituality, which is personal and which can be mine, and trying to fit into the box of some religion. And so this book is actually an interspiritual approach to the Enneagram. So it offers what my ministry, my Evolving Enneagram work offers, which is a place where everyone gets to belong just by virtue of this shared quest for truth, even if what I believe is different from what you believe. So it's the hope is to speak to people who maybe, you know, from more, there are some books that are like my book that are written for only Christians, for instance. You know, a lot of like, it's basically a 40-day devotional practice. It's a 40-day practice guide where there are invitations for folks of every number once a day. I've only really seen this in the Christian realm. And I wanted to offer something based on my background that really is open, is interspiritual, that sometimes encompasses Buddhist practices as well as mystical Christian practices. And so, yeah, so in that sense, it's almost like giving a book that I would need. And the other piece is a lot of Enneagram work now is very expensive if you want to find a coach or something. And so in a way, this book is a 40-day guide so that you can journey on your own, or you can journey with a group of friends, like through a book study. And so it's a way of almost like having the expert at home with you on your personal journey. Yeah. So
that was amazing.
Spiritual framework. Yeah.
So when will that be pre books out?
So my publisher hasn't given me an exact date, but we know it's going to be first quarter of next year. Which feels like a long time. And then, you know, then I'm like, well, maybe not so long. It's going to happen really quickly and such. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Exciting. Let's turn our attention to this conference in Cairo in January 24, where you were talking about the seasons. I have, of course, please correct me, but I had kind of this feeling about that we as human beings are part of the seasons, but also the seasons are part of us. So would you say that you put an extra layer on the types, or will the types be types and then it's tool for opening conversations? How does it fit together, this seasons and the Enneagram?
Yeah, great question. So I think maybe I can offer a little background regarding how I came to that topic that might help answer this question. Well, first of all, you know, the theme of the conference is remember what you are. And I love that little distinction of what versus who. And because for me, from my Unity background, we make a clear distinction when we say the truth of what you are is spiritual, is spirit. And so that's a what. And personhood is that individual expression of that one infinite spirit. So I already really connected with the title of the conference to say the essence of us is a what, not a who. It's almost like spirit versus ego, right? I mean, I don't want to say versus in the way that where I don't believe in the polarity of demonizing the ego, but there's this sense of where's the foundation, where's the starting point? And when I teach the Enneagram, I teach it as, so this idea that the ego or the personality sits on the circumference of the Enneagram. So it's on the circle, but it's on the surface. You know, I mean, really, the prototype is the type three, right? Like as on the surface of self. And the journey is into the center, into the circle for the fullness of the wholeness of our spirit. But that doesn't make the surface bad or wrong. It's a part of the whole. It's not rejected, but it's only part of the whole. So the idea is that through the spiritual journey, we go in and then we go out. So I want to tie this back to this idea of seasons. I think too many people like try to take all sorts of things and overlay them with the Enneagram, you know, to have like their unique brand or something like that. And I definitely am not trying to say, oh, here are the seasons and here's how we're going to correlate the seasons with you. Instead, this comes from, again, when I was younger as a teacher, you know, there was this need to be the expert where you're telling people all this information, right? You're giving them all this information. For me, more and more, I realized, well, if I really believe that you have within you this innate wisdom and power and strength, that I just need to ask you good questions. I don't need to give you the answer. So it's not like I'm going to lay out and map out how the seasons relate to the Enneagram. That's not mine to do. It's more of like, as you grapple with the topic of the seasons, your own wisdom is going to emerge. And the seasons are so valuable because they're universal in our experience, right? There's something like when we talk about nature, they are literally nature happening, and our personal reflections on that will bring forth wisdom for us individually. And so that's how I like to use the seasons. But I like how you brought up this idea of like layers, because yeah, if you're paying attention, you're going to get what is happening at different layers, right? Where there's an invitation to, you know, like I can share a little bit about the session, you know, the surprise question. It isn't so much what season do you like, which seems like the most obvious question, but more of like, what season are you, right? What season, like, do you relate to, and which season do you not? And so what we're doing is we're using it as a mirror to your own self-awareness and your own, what do I identify as and what do I not? And what I don't identify as is like part of my shadow, right? And part of maybe parts of my wholeness in that circle that I've rejected. And so we begin a journey there into looking at these parts that we say no to rather than embracing, you know, the full seasons of our lives, right? Of our being. Yeah. So I'm watching you think.
I really enjoyed your session. And I was also thinking, I'm from Scandinavia. Winter is dark and cold. And the sun gets up at 10 and down at 3. And it's just raining, dark, black, gray, cold. But if I lived someplace else, maybe winter is not that bad. Mm. Winter is, yeah, if you live in Egypt or something, okay, now suddenly you wear a hat in the evening.
Right.
And maybe it rains a day, a month or something. But how hard can that be? Come here and talk about winter and your type in Scandinavia. So do you think that people from different regions will have different reflections on seasons and that type? You know, the question, which of the seasons do you like and dislike? You think there's also a little bias or based on geography?
100%. Yes. Yes, for sure. And again, but that's not, to me, that's where the juiciness is of it, which is, it's not about, you noticed, oh, I don't want to give away the whole session, you know, but you notice like, I shared a story, a parable, if you will, but I didn't give the end. And very deliberately, because you give the interpretation of the story and not me. And it's your interpretation that will tell you about yourself, because this is about, again, look like having this mirror to yourself and how you relate to things and what you're telling me about it, you know, can tell me about how you relate to the world or your own being or aspects of how that lives in you, right? And so that's where we can begin a journey that goes deeper. If I then start to work one-on-one with you, I would begin to investigate that of like the comparison then. So what is that about? You know, is that about like, am I identified with things being harder? You know, and how does that, you know, how's that for me? And so we start to take that journey into the self. And so that is just like one layer. But I also, I'll jump in and share that when we talk about multiple layers, what I love about the seasons again is like with you there, I found people were talking to me well after the session to say they're still thinking about this, mm-hmm. right? I see you nodding, you know, just that because it's something that lives with you, which is lives with you and for you. And that grappling is part of what the session is intended to do, right? Because it's also trusting that you have this wisdom within you and that your grappling is meaningful for you and that there's something tangible, again, the use of story and poetry, parables, I think can be so powerful in this way that they live in us because they touch something universal in us. And they trigger something, right? And so that's a piece of it. But I want to say that also a parallel framework that I brought up when you first learned my age, right? Is that literally the season, or actually not literally, metaphorically the seasons of our lives. You know, I turned 50. I was like, oh, you know, it's like, okay, I'm not old, but I'm not young. So, you know, it's like definitely can't say I'm young anymore. You know, And what that meant for me as a woman in a society, especially in the U.S., that values a young age, which is different than Asia, you know, different than Vietnam, where, you know, our elders are held with great respect. Our elders are invited to the dinner table first. We invite them before we even sit down. You know, we serve them rice. Like that's not the same culture that we have in America at all. But since, you know, I'm a three. In this culture. And like, there's a grief that happens for me within this coming into that. And like, will I strive to be like what the society seems to value? Or will I deepen into owning this phase of my life, which is a different symbolic season? So there are layers of that. And part of why I was inspired to use the seasons is that as a minister, I have literally journeyed with people where I've christened babies, you know, and I have sat on the deathbed of some of my congregants and journeyed with them in hospice. And so literally going through the seasons of our lives and understanding what good is Enneagram work if it doesn't meet us in the territory of our real, felt, lived life journey, right? You know, yeah.
My sense is that there are so many levels in what you talk about here, and it seems like there are archetypical stories within stories.
Yes.
So now you're telling me about a culture layer around seasons. There is a self-sensed or experienced relationship to season. There could also be, I could look at you in some season, I can look at myself in another season, and I could get something out of that. You know, will we have good conversations or will we not have that good conversations? So I can see seasons being metaphors or initiators for narratives in so many levels.
Yeah. I know that you are passionate about the next generation. And I think that, you know, what you're speaking to is like this notion that, yes, like any generation, right? Like this could be applicable to a group of people in their latter years as much as a group of people just beginning life, right? Yeah. And about to kind of traverse this terrain where they're shifting, anyone in a transition. And I feel passionate about supporting people in transitions in life. And so that is one piece of it as well. Our society, I think that part will go to the little I know about the work that you do in this area, but I know that when you were telling me about your passion for serving this generation, it just struck me how because it's like, you know, throwing out the baby with the bathwater. Old rituals don't have meaning for much of us anymore, right? They've been stripped of their meaning. And so we need new rituals. And I think like the seasons and rites of passage, I think, yeah, is what I'm talking about. Yeah. That there's a lack of that support as we enter into these different passages, right, of life. And there's a need for that, but not one that is just outdated and empty, right? Like in religion, a lot of people are like, oh, all these things that they do in the church feel empty, you know, that we need to find ways that it's meaningful. Otherwise, you know, we can feel so alone in the world, right? And that speaks to something. I think, I don't know if you know this about me, but speaking to offering what it is that we didn't get, I actually used to think that I was the loneliest person in the world.
What?
I believe that for the first, like, I'm going to cry, first decades of my life. And you would never think that now. Right? No, I mean, people who meet me now are like, you're crazy. Like, you know, you're like one of the most social. I was one of the shyest kids ever. But I was deeply lonely because I was the black sheep in my family. Of course, when we moved to America, I was the black sheep in that, you know, I wasn't white, there were very few Asians where we were. And this sense of companioning people, helping them to feel that they're not alone each time they journey into something new, they cross a threshold, is very, very meaningful to me. Yeah.
If I'm looking for a guide that would help me with a passage, I would look for you.
Oh, thank you.
I always felt safe in your conversations. And I can see that what you're sharing here is you come from experience. Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's say, just to do a little practice work here, that I really hate winters, like really. And I love summers. Spring and autumn, not so much. But winter is negative, negative, negative. Our summers, positive, positive, positive.
Mm.
And the other two is like, whatever.
Mm.
Slightly annoyed.
Yes.
How could I use that in my life? And I relate to type 3 as well. How would that be an opener for me? For conversation and reflection.
Hypothetically. So, hypothetically, right?
Well, we can also do it very realistically.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. Well, so the key to this, I would say, is that too often when people work with the Enneagram, they think about what rather than why. So the question wouldn't be just what, right? Like, oh, you know, your affinity for summer over winter. And then, you know, but I would kind of think about how those are two extremes, right? And kind of disregarding the other. It's all the like produce or death, like nothing, barren, right? Like these extremes. So I already have that in the back of my mind. But, you know, if I'm working with you, I may not bring that forward right away. I may just ask the next question, which is, it's not so much what about winter, but why? So because you've already talked a few times in our short time here together about winter and like with a pretty negative spin on like what winter is.
Oh, yeah.
So the more important question is why, right? Like, what about it?
Hmm. Thank you. That's a good question. So if I should think out loud and share my process, it's dark and it's contracted, it's limited, it's hopeless, no light. And it's like it's just about surviving, holding my breath until I can see one day with the blue sky and some sun.
Yeah.
But before that, it's like a part of the hero's journey where I have to face a challenge and I don't understand why me.
Yeah.
It's really hard for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. And so my invitation would be to consider some of those descriptions you use: dark, contracted, hopeless, right? And to actually experience what comes up inside of you when you reflect on those words.
Something is coming to my mind here, and that is, I cannot come into my garden. It's frozen. Everything is, you know, yeah, it's frozen, or all frozen, all covered with snow. So that would be highly risky doing garden work or with all the snow. And it's like, if I haven't prepared well in the autumn, then I'm powerless in winter and can only view the result of bad or poor planning in the autumn.
Yeah.
It's like, hold your breath, hibernate, curl up, and hope that the berries are still there on the bushes where you remember them or some months ago. It is being powerless.
Powerless over the result in spring. The the fruits.
Yeah. And I have no use.
Yes.
I'm not useful. It's like, what to do in my garden? Nothing to do in my garden. What? Thank you. I'm kind of getting this images that if I cannot use myself or be at use or at purpose, I get frustrated.
Yes. Yes. And you get frustrated because if you aren't useful, what are you?
Holding my breath.
Waiting to be useful. But if you aren't useful now, what are you?
It's like I'm left with I shared with you that I had my concussion like a year ago, and the only thing I can do to heal it is doing nothing. And doing nothing is it's easy to do nothing if you're asleep and then just go to bed and sleep. But you can do nothing when you're awake and conscious, and that means be aware. Be conscious, be awake. And with whatever I do, or cooking, cleaning, sneaking down, buying some flowers and bringing to my girlfriend, so we just have a little life in house that's not from the garden, but spending an hour in the flower shop to pick exactly what I would like. So it fosters some awakeness in all my activities. And I kind of liked it. It was like a gift coming from pain. But I have to practice. I really have to practice. It's difficult to stay awake. And it's like winter is the same thing.
Yeah.
I can only stay awake with my frozen garden, where there's nothing I can do. And it's difficult. It's difficult to be present. It's difficult to stay with what is. It's painfully difficult.
Yeah. No, I have.
Hey, maybe that's it. And it's not that I feel dead. It's more that presence is overwhelming. See what kind of conversation is coming out of talking about seasons. Wow, thank you.
Yeah.
And I can understand why people will come up to you after your session and say, hey, I'm still wondering. Because it is putting something in emotion. So it is, it's a good metaphor. Thank you.
Yeah, for sure.
Then I'd like to kind of take our conversation on another little turn here.
Sure.
The question is, what if you got offered a lot of resources, time and money and people, to do some research, scientific research about the Enneagram?
Oh, wow.
And you should direct them. And it's just a lot of resources, a lot of brilliant people, a lot of time and money, but you will tell them what to explore. What would it be?
Wow. I feel completely unprepared for this question.
Very good.
But if I had to answer like right now, you know, my deepest passion, I think, as you know, is it's like the life of soul. It's spirituality. It's connection to this invisible source of love and wisdom and presence that is available to all of us. And so, you know, as you were talking about like having unlimited resources, you know, my first thing was, well, of course, I would act. The good news is I would actually do what I'm doing, like, but more on a larger scale. But I would make it available to all. But we were talking about research in particular. Then in order to benefit maybe more people being able to hear about the Enneagram because of the science behind it, I would love research on people who practice a contemplative meditative practice and the impact of that on shifts or transformation in their brain waves, whatever it is. Because, you know, I don't normally think from a scientific method model, right? My background's in philosophy, theology, you know, and at the same time, I have a direct experience of people radically shifting, including myself. Again, for people to say, I mean, I think the biggest testament is when an ex calls you up. It was like, who are you? Like, what? I remember one time when it was like an ex called me, it was like, what did you do with Nian? I was like, that was probably the biggest compliment I've ever gotten, because the person I was with him was not ideal. but if that could actually be measured in some way through brain waves, et cetera, or some other studies that show the impact, because I see it in my life. I see these shifts and changes as a result of combining contemplative practice, which is a practice of death, actually. So you talk about winter. It's like a daily practice of dying to who you think you are and being open to this rebirth, right? Not you birthing yourself, but being open to something more universal, right? We don't have to call it God. I'm not attached to that term. The universe, whatever it is, truth. Yeah. So that's what I would spend the money on. Yeah.
Interesting. Interesting. And I have a question more, kind of might be another surprise, but if somebody that you don't know, but it's a good and great and wise and beautiful soul could understand this term well, to take you, use you, put you in a place on the planet where that person intuitively would sense, feel, think that you would do a lot of great good, and you could whisper that person, put me here. And that person had all the resources, and you could stay there for 2, 3, 4, 5 years and do your thing. Where on the planet would you like to be placed?
Wow. Yeah. So I'm not committing myself to this on the spot answer.
Only because
I have to do a little research to figure out. But it would be something. So I don't have a specific person or group of people, but you're actually having me admit some of like my deepest passions that are a little bit hidden, which is I have always believed that one day I would be a spiritual mentor to like the world's leaders, like to people who are in positions to make major decisions. That I would be a source of spiritual guidance, I guess, yeah, and nourishment for them, right? So to really spiritually feed and nourish leaders is a big thing. But I'm talking about leaders who have impact. So I don't have a specific idea, because obviously if they're open to a spiritual guide, they're already somewhat, you know, like on the path already. So yeah, and that's key to me as well. Like I don't... one of, I think, my skills is that I don't push my way in anywhere. Like even if there's a couple and one person wants the therapy, unless the other person emails me as well, you know, like, we're not doing it, like, because you have to be ready. You're not like, I want to know you both want this, you know, kind of. And so that, yes. So it would have to be a place where it was wanted like that. But definitely, again, you know, I have a legal background. So that helps a little bit in terms of this idea that I'm not just some woo-woo whatever, but there's just a space where I feel like I can make shifts and maybe even in a conflict resolution position. Yeah. Because I am a mediator as well. Like, I'm a professional mediator, and that bringing peace to the world is a passion of mine. Yeah.
Thanks. We are about to end our beautiful conversation here. Is there anything that you think is haven't been said, or we should also cover? Or then there's some. It's time to kind of bring something up if I missed something.
We asked such great questions. I think that if anything, one thing I want to share that I think is really important is, you know, a lot of people, when they're new to the Enneagram journey, the Enneagram is the end all be all, right? You know, and I think you could just hear from the way I talked about things that, like, for me, Enneagram is background framework, that the territory of our lives and of our being should always be what leads. Then we bring in the Enneagram to see how it might support. But when we lead with the Enneagram, it's almost like we're putting forth that box, whether it's a religious box or an Enneagram type box of, like, we're trying to make you fit into something. And so it's more about, let's see the reality of the territory of being that actually presents. And then with the greatest compassion possible, let's bring forth some Enneagram teachings and ideas that might offer some reflection or guidance on our journey, right? So I think that's really important to share.
I love that. I love that. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot. Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot, Nyan, for taking your time to share your stories, share your perspectives. And if people would go to a conference or someplace or in the future and meet you, do you already know that you will be on a conference speaking somewhere?
I haven't applied for the next one yet. Let's talk offline about which ones you're going to, maybe. So yeah, I mean, I have a few events in the United States that will be happening. One in Connecticut, March 8th through 10th, where I'll be leading a contemplative Enneagram soul journey, you know. And then in Texas, I wish I could remember the day. I think it's the April 13th, that weekend, where that is actually going to be for spiritual but not religious, like really kind of supporting people who, again, maybe feel like they don't belong in any particular tradition, but having a space where you could practice a spiritually based Enneagram practice. So those are a few of the places. But online, my groups are ongoing and all are welcome. We get people from all walks of life, from multiple countries and different religions. We have Muslims, we have Buddhists, we have Christians and people who don't identify with any spirituality who join us for our, like, weekly online groups where we offer support for, you know, this idea that transformation isn't a one-time deal, it's a way of life. So that's the core of Evolving Enneagram's work. Yeah. So
beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, same.
Tak fordi du lyttede med, og husk at tjekke show notes, hvis du gerne vil vide mere om enneagrammet og de 9 typer. Think About It holder en masse spændende kurser og forløb, og du er velkommen.